Recording.
Yay.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, squad.
Happy. Well, I'm going to stop saying the days. You don't need to know where we are or when.
It's none of your business.
Although I do want to say it's December 5th only because I have two top of the class notes. Happy birthday to Tony Todd. That was yesterday. Also RIP because he passed away last month. And then Jersey Shore, I believe, was released 15 years ago on December 3rd, 2009.
That is beautiful, but I feel aged.
I know. It is both beautiful and sad. You were the one who told me to watch it. We were at a party and you were like, you haven't seen Jersey Shore yet? You've got to watch it.
Well, then I'm like, who was I watching it? You know, maybe my roommate Holly liked it. That would be like the kind of thing she'd make me watch and I'd be like, oh, this is kind of funny.
And then remember the second season was premiering I think it was the first weekend at Keene. Like it was like the first Friday we had or whatever.
I think so.
Or Thursday maybe. I'm like Friday. And then we didn't have TVs, neither of us. And we're like, but what are we going to do? It's the Jersey Shore season 2 premiere. And so you're like, oh, there's this girl that I met last year who loves me. We'll go
and
watch it.
I did not like her. Yeah, that was so mean. But she was a dick, and I actually don't feel bad at all.
No. Yeah, we've discussed it many times since then because I was like, why don't we care? And I'm like, oh right, because she was a dick. Because I was like, that was one of the ruder things. Because then she was like, oh, we're gonna go out now, right? And we were like, nah, we're tired. Although we were dressed clearly to go out,
like to go out after. We were like, yeah, we're just gonna go see our friends. bye.
Vanderpump Rules. Well, okay, the show like isn't over, but it's being recast. So like RIP to the old cast, but not in a tragic way. They've been fired. And I'm frankly okay with it. One thing about Bravo fans is when we're done. But I'm also kind of like, you know, it's so hard to say goodbye.
I mean, I don't think they could top Scandoval. So it's kind of like, where are we going to go from here? And Ariana is like too big for them now. She's like, I'm good.
Exactly. That people, well, they didn't listen. We all said, do not, whatever you fucking do. We're like, do not try to make this a win for Sandoval this season. And they're like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to try to make this a win for Sandoval this season.
How? And they
spun the narrative in like to be that Ariana was not allowing the group to heal, basically, and her bitterness was keeping them from all becoming friends again and forgiving and forgetting. So also forgetting, speaking of, that at the time of filming, it was only like 3 months past when this had all happened. So they were like, Ariana, like, can you move on? Stop being so mad at him. He's clearly sorry. He was not clearly sorry.
I've never seen a less sorry person in my life.
Thank you. And you didn't even watch the show.
No, I didn't. But I've seen clips and he's just like...
the least sorry human, right? It's like the audacity, like, and it's like he has the audacity, but also he's like, I can't believe the whole thing is such a mess. So like they all, with the exception of like one person, took that stance and tanked the show effectively because we're all pissed and we're like, we're not watching it if this is what you're gonna do. So I think they realize that they can't film with Ariana if Sandoval's gonna be on it. And like, I don't know why. I think they would have had to get rid of literally everyone to like make that work. So they were like, fine, we'll just get rid of everyone.
Exhausting.
It's exhausting.
For Bravo fans.
Also, the CEO of United Healthcare was shot dead in Manhattan.
Oh my God.
I know, a lot's going on.
I did hear that, but...
Wow, intense.
Very intense.
Intense 6 minutes, everyone. I'm sorry. I can't wait to see what I edit out.
And you'll never know.
Probably the part about the conspiracy.
Ooh. And this is going to be intense because I hated this episode.
I know. Oh yeah, so back to that, we were discussing right before we hit record how much we don't really like this episode, y'all.
Oh,
but like,
guys, buckle up.
I've also resolved not to say y'all anymore. Sorry, I'm taking it. I can't cut it out, it already happened, but just know that I'm trying not to say it anymore. But yeah, buckle up. It's weird.
It's such a weird episode. I think it got cut and re-edited before it aired.
I can confirm it did, because in the opener, well, not the opener, when we see Finn and Monique again, so we already spoiled that part. Monique is back.
Yes.
They are in the same outfits that they were in the episode, in Wrong is Right, a.k.a. Michael.
Yes.
That where she was like, huh, you're here for my job. They're in the exact same outfit, so we're supposed to. Also, it's October.
So, all right, we'll just get into it. I've got a bunch of shit to say in between. Oh, guys, buckle up, because today we are talking about Law & Order Special Victims Unit Season 2, Episode 16, but I can tell you not filmed 16.
No.
Runaway. Original air date, March 2nd, 2001, directed by Richard Dobbs, who directed my last episode, Paranoia. But this is his last directing credit for SVU, so bye, Richard Dobbs. So I went through the production codes for this season, and they clearly just filmed this probably fourth or fifth out of every episode filmed this season. And then it didn't air until now, so it just makes no sense with the direction the rest of the episodes went in. So I think they went back, did some retconning, and it doesn't really work at all.
Yeah.
Also think that, like, back in the early aughts when they filmed this, it didn't really matter the order you released episodes in as much, because
people
went week from week and you couldn't really rewatch it. So it was kind of like whatever.
I'm sure there was some crazy that, or like people like zealots who like take notes on episodes. Like, I'm sure there were early recappers who were marking those things and being like, this is ridiculous. It is a little ridiculous. IAB.
They're back.
Yeah.
Why do I get all the IAB Richard Dobbs episodes?
Dude.
I don't want them.
I was going to say, dude, we've had like more than two in season two, right?
So there was this one, there was Paranoia, and then did IAB show up earlier? Well, so IAB was not the original people that were mad at Stabler and Monique. That was the commish.
Yeah, the commish. Who I believe IAB like sniffs around on behalf of. So shouldn't they all just be mad at the commish? Like, why are they so mad? I mean, I guess they're mad at everyone. So the scenes that they were filming with IAB, I'm just wondering, and I will never get an answer to this question. I will never. I'm wondering if we're supposed to be in October in those moments, or if we're in March where we're supposed to be, where we're going to be next episode.
Because there are no date cards.
No.
Like, they never like flash the IAB office, Cragen's in trouble.
Yeah.
March 3rd, 2001.
Right. We are back in October 2000.
This episode is chaos, and we open with chaos. Cragen and Stabler are being led through what looks like an office building, and they're being briefed by a mustachioed short king. There are other police around. They're wearing like vests. They're carrying rifles. So I wrote, it's obviously serious. By the way, my notes are so unserious for this episode, because I wrote, guys, I think we're back at the internet. Sergeant Frank Foster of Brooklyn Narcotics came to the internet. It's actually like an internet journalism site or whatever. And he came here with his wife and son to harass this guy whose job it is to take videos of street youths and put them on the internet. I did not know that was a job.
Yeah, it's like a street journalism thing where he's like profiling them, I guess. But then he's like, later on he's like, and they don't know I'm doing it. And I'm like,
oh, and this feels, I don't know, this feels like something people would do more nowadays. Like people with TikTok being like, I'm going to interview the local homeless, unhoused population and post on TikTok.
Here's $100.
Oh, I hate reels or TikToks where people are like, filming themselves doing something nice for people. I'm like, you're an asshole.
It's disgusting. And I don't know how long it will take. I'm going to be that millennial in 30 years going, it needs to be illegal. I'm already saying it. Like, apparently Australia, it's now illegal if you're under 13 to, like, access social media. And I'm like, good. They should raise it to 21.
Oh, like the ones where people film themselves and they're like, hey, man, come in here. Order whatever you want. And they're just like, focusing on the person's face. And
yeah. Like a fucking dog. And the same ones where they're like, oh, I found this kitten on the side of the road. And I'm like, and you are going to one-handed take care of it while you film yourself.
Put your phone down. I'm so old. Put your phone down, children.
It's so embarrassing. And the way, because people make money off of it, it's never going
to. And the worst part is what you have to do is kind of like click like not interested.
Yes.
Or just avoid it. Because if you comment, hey, you're a fucking dick, then you're engaging and they get internet points either way. So
exactly. All the comments like on the cringy video. We just need to stop. That's why it needs to be illegal. And I'm going to make it happen someday.
Please do. Someone has to. Sergeant Frank Foster, his daughter is missing, and I guess he saw her video on this site, and he wants this guy to tell him where she is, but I guess he won't, except in a two minutes he's going to. Sorry.
So this is so weird.
the police are filming him with a camera kind of around a corner. And then when Cragen arrives, they hand him a screen. I wrote they handed him an iPad, but that's not true. They get a monitor because that's not a thing yet. So now we can all see Frank. He's in plain clothes and he's brandishing a gun at a younger black gentleman who is seated at a computer. Cragen calls over to Frank, who immediately is like, walks over. He's like, I'm not a threat. And I was like, well, why are we here?
Also,
what?
Cragen like introduced himself. He was like, Frank Foster, this is Donald Cragen of SVU. And then the guy goes, Donnie. And he's like, Frank. And I'm like, so wait a minute. You knew each other? Why did you? We tried to keep it cool. Like, we have to keep it cool. And he's like, Donnie. The man who stood at my wedding. Like,
oh, hey.
That'd be me and you. I'd be like, you'd be like, hello, this is Sergeant Brittany Porter. And I'd be like, Britta?
Hey.
Hey, best friend. You're like,
do you still live it and you read out my address and my phone number? It's like, oh, fuck.
Remember that conversation we had 2 minutes ago and you were like, don't do this, you stupid bitch.
And then don't tell the cops that we know each other.
You put your hands remember up that? You're like, here, just take me.
Here. So he lowers his gun and goes over to Cragen and Stabler and he's like, this isn't over till I know where my daughter is. And then he's like, I want her safe or shoot me now.
Liam Neeson. Like, Harrison Ford.
Okay. So Cragen gets the other police officers to lower their weapons and he and Stabler follow Foster back to the man who's named Tito. And he's understandably pissed. He's like, he slaps me around. What do you think he's going to do to his daughter? Foster's annoying wife and son, which I did not realize until later, are there. And she's like, we just want our daughter safe. Why are you here too?
Well, also, at the beginning, there were like four hostages plus the taker. But really, it's like two, maybe three if you include the son because he looked hella embarrassed to be there. But like the wife is clearly there, like trying to straw. She probably loaded the gun.
So literally, I think the hostages are Tito and the unfortunate guy who happens to sit kitty corner to him, who kind of turns around and is like, what the fuck? So Tito's like, clearly the daughter didn't feel safe at home. So he shows Cragen and Stabler a clip of the daughter.
No, I'm laughing. I'm sorry. I'm laughing because this is like this video.
So we get a video of Ms. Jill Foster. And she's like, mom freaks out about lipstick. Like, purple's going to kill me. Dad's like, I don't exist. Says I couldn't find my way out of a neighborhood like I'm stupid or something. No Emmy for Jill Foster.
Oh my god.
I would have left if I were Cragen and Stabler. I would have been like, okay.
In Jill's defense, and this is the only time I'm going to defend Jill, purple lipstick was very of the times in fashion. Yes.
She's so annoying that Stabler doesn't even make one Maureen reference.
Literally staring at that note, I'm like...
Stop it.
I don't know if it's because Cragen is the one who's screaming in outrage this time, but Elliot, for some reason, of the Stabler, same age.
Stabler always manages to make a, you don't understand because you're not a father, quip.
Right? Like,
not a one in this episode.
Literally not one. In fact, like the rando cop in the beginning says it because they're like, oh, he stormed in here with a gun holding two men hostage. I would have done the same thing, though, honestly, if it were my daughter. And then Cragen's like, same. I'm like, what? I think he could have handled. Anyway.
In the video, Tito asks Jill if Frank beats her. And she's like, he's like a cop. It sucks at my house. My parents blow. Sorry, that's my Jill impression. I've been working on it. So out of nowhere, a creepy man approaches her and greets Tito, and he starts chatting up the daughter as Tito, in real life, explains that this guy is bad news. He runs raves. We're going to hear all about those soon. Don't you worry. So the guy gives her a flyer and tells her she could earn $500. So Cragen asks where she is, and Tito's like, I don't know, but she was hanging out with these kids downtown in like the meatpacking district. So now Cragen asks Frank for his gun, which he should have done at the beginning of this scene, but whatever. And Frank tells him he can't hand the case over to missing persons because they've done nothing. Cragen's like, what's the alternative? Which you would think means they're not going to investigate because, you know, this is a missing persons case, not an SVU case.
And the video, which looks like found footage, speaks for itself. Jill
She ran away on purpose. My parents blow. It sucks at my house.
I can't wear purple lipstick. Ugh. My mom is so dramatic about purple lipstick, but here I go running away because I'm not allowed to wear it. I just feel like the dad could have handled this. Like, I know it's a serious situation because, like, she could have been trafficked. But, like, Tito's pretty cool. I feel like
Tito's a really nice guy.
He's a nice guy. If he had just shown up, if the whole family had just politely shown up, brought Tito a pie and been like, hey, our idiot daughter.
This video.
Yeah, she ran away because I wouldn't let her wear purple lipstick. It's a whole thing. Do you know where she's at?
And Tito's like, oh, he probably beats her. And Jello never said that. Honestly, this episode, everyone except Cabot is an idiot. So Frank hands over the gun and the other officers move in and cuff him. Dun, dun.
Dun, dun.
IAB is back because this squad cannot behave themselves.
Again, and they're so weird about IAB. Like every IAB episode, they're like, oh, these pieces of shit. But they're always investigating, like, legitimate problems. A la two episodes ago, a legitimate problem. Two cops working for a drug dealer selling drugs to children.
So Kraken enters a room where a man and a woman are waiting to interview him. And they tell him they'll be recording this conversation. He's being questioned about serious irregularities in the Foster investigation. So we're like, uh-oh, clearly what we just thought earlier isn't going to end well. If he refuses to answer any questions, he'll be suspended. And Kraken starts telling his tale. He was like, I was the hostage negotiator on duty that day.
Okay, good.
Come again?
I have questions. So, like,
what?
They just outsource to other departments?
I thought that was a specific job.
Me too. I didn't know a captain
of a whole ass special unit.
What if this had happened not in October 2000, but in February 2001, where all the shit was popping off every single week? We couldn't just spare Kraken to deal with fucking Jill Foster's, quote, oh disappearance. God. Disappearance. That's what they're calling it. They're like, she's missing. I'm like, she's not missing. I could tell you where she is.
Also, if Frank's a detective, why didn't he just solve the case himself on his own time?
Yeah, like, why didn't he take time off? And then, yeah, Liam Neeson's daughter was whole full body trafficked, like, on the phone with him. He handled that shit so calmly. This guy busts into some location, brings his wife and son. The clunkiest shit ever. Why were they there with a gun? The whole thing is this is insane. I'm like spiraling right now.
And it took me a watch each to realize, like, my first watch, didn't realize that was his wife. Second watch, I was like, he brought his wife. Third watch, I was like, and his underage son?
Right? Well, because they were, like, hostages. I'm like, no, his wife and he were, like, get in the car, Timmy. And then they took their son to a
unnamed son.
Who's kind of like dumb later on.
Oh, he's so dumb.
I'm a little dumb with him, by the way. Took me a minute, but I was also so uninvested.
So when he arrived, he learned it was Frank Foster. They've known each other for over 30 years. They were at the academy together. And they rightfully ask Kraken why he didn't disarm Frank right away. And Kraken gets really defensive. He's like, I analyzed the situation and I determined that he was not a threat. And I was right because nothing bad happened in that scene.
I can't believe he had the balls to say that particular line because you were not right. Anyone who's willing to bring a gun anywhere for no reason, which this certainly was, they are not a threat.
Anybody else, if they had behaved this way, would have been shot on sight.
Insane. Like, I just can't believe.
Actually yells at Kraken because, as you can guess, that's super bad. And Kraken, you know when Kraken gets like all like, he's like, oh, I wasn't about to paint a bullseye on a good cop.
That is what he does this whole episode. And I beg you, I implore you, because they give us no details other than Kraken knowing him for 30 years. Where is this guy a good cop? They're like, this is a good cop. The entire force is behind you. And I'm like, he didn't. Okay, well, I'm wrong. Go on. Because they technically, they do reference. They're like, he once saved Kraken's life.
One time.
We get no details. So I don't even know if that fucking shit is true. We got more details from Lenny Briscoe about their blackout nights in fucking Jersey City.
I know. So they basically yell at him some more and they're like, you shouldn't have even taken this case. You're goddamn SVU. And Kraken's like, oh, Jill Foster is underage And because she was seen in the company of a sex offender and pimp, I can make this an SVU case. So he's big mad. And so this is, I should have written it down, but this is where he starts like yelling like staccato sentences. I reached out to my former detective, Monique Jeffries. I did this. I did that. And it's like,
he's like, this is all the shit that I did. They're like unauthorized.
Well, IAB is like, so do you think this was normal procedure? And Craig's, nothing about this case was normal. This is one of the most basic ass cases they've investigated.
Thank you. Do you think that the writers were like, this was kind of, we should put in IAB scenes?
I don't really know like what goes into deciding like a season's episode order, but I'm thinking because this was a junky episode, they kind of probably kept pushing it back. But then when they finally were like, oh shit, we have to release this at some point, they were like, all right, well, now it doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah.
So now we've got to add these really weird IAB scenes where we're not even going to show the faces of these agents more than once.
Yeah, they did it once at the very beginning and then they Charlie Browned it.
And then he goes, this was a cop's daughter. What would you have done?
So much.
My job.
I would have done everything differently. Everything you did and didn't do, I would have done and done-n't.
Done-n't. Well, done-done. We're in the bullpen and they are watching the video again. Stabler pauses the video to give a rundown about Lance Kanick. He's the promoter for the very fake-sounding Rainlight Raves, which made me think of Tim Robinson. I just kept picturing Tim Robinson being like, hi, it's me, Lance Kanick, owner of Rainlight Raves.
That is very, I think you should leave coded.
So, Cragen chimes in to say that in 87, Lance Kanick was running ooh-wee escort services, providing sex workers and drugs to Wall Streeters. This episode is not serious.
No.
Ooh-wee escort. And that's how he says it. He's like the owners of ooh-wee escort services.
In 87, he was running ooh-wee escort service.
All I can think of is the beginning song from the critically acclaimed film, Honey.
So Lance Kanick, in all seriousness, did beat a sex worker to death with a tire iron. And the only reason he isn't in prison for life is because a rookie cop fucked up the scene. So he only did 7. No big deal. So now Finn chimes in. Finn is, as I think we've said earlier, he's back in the style. And in fact, the very same clothes he was wearing the very first time we meet him, which is like a zipped up windbreaker. And, like, jewelry, which is gone immediately in the very next episode when he starts wearing his three-piece suits. But he's back to, I guess, what I would call street style as opposed to kind of his more dressed up posh look.
And this is what he was wearing in that one episode. So it's from that episode. So in reality, in real life, it is the same day. And this was filmed that day, too.
As I should mention, oh, hi, Monique Jeffries is here. Long time no see. What's up? But the last time we saw both of them in these outfits, they were having the very awkward exchange where, oh, I guess you're here for my job. Oh, well, this is awkward. It makes no sense.
Right?
She couldn't just like put her shirt on backwards or something to make it look a little different. So anyway, Finn helpfully tells the squad that raves are where you score drugs. I was like, do these Chads really not know that?
I feel like 99 was like, well, no, the 80s, like huge club scene, lots of drugs.
I thought there were a lot of raves in the 90s, too.
Yes. Very late to this party.
So Munch and Finn are sent to talk to Kanick, and Benson and Stabler are sent to talk with Tito. And Cragen tells Jeffrey she'll coordinate from here. And I wrote, coordinate what? Anyway, everyone's off.
Well, because remember when this episode was filmed, technically she was on desk duty for being like, I like to sleep with suspects.
So Benson and Stabler join Tito in the nice interrogation room, and Stabler introduces Benson. Tito takes one look at her, and he's like, no one's going to talk to you in this mall, queen. Tito asks why he can't have Jeffries, and they're like, she has to make us coffee. Anyway, what's this? So this refers to a contraption Tito wears so he can get interviews of the runaways. He wears this like bandana around his head, and then there's a hidden camera like tucked into his bandana. Once he takes the bandana off, it looks really obvious. But when it's on, I guess I didn't really notice.
Yeah, I think it's probably an okay guys. Like, I personally would be like, an ill-fitting bandana, but like, I'm not gonna say anything.
Yeah,
like, you don't go, what kind of idiot goes around to people at a party and goes, why is this bandana so ill-fitting?
Well, dun dun, we're at Riker's Island. Ugh, this scene is so boring.
I hate Frank, dude.
Craig is visiting sucks. Frank, who's very anxious about Jill. He could be out there looking for her, but he committed a bad crime, and now he's at Riker's.
Everyone feels so bad for him. Like,
well, so he knows that since he took hostages, his career and probably his life are like pretty much over. And Craig sits down to make him feel worse about the situation. He's like, I stood up at your wedding, which made me like just picture him being at his wedding and standing up. But I know that means he's probably a groomsman, but I was just picturing him standing up and clapping.
One single tear, because this is back when he drank, I'm sure. And so he's like clapping and being, and he's staring at the wall. He's like, I stood up at your wedding. They're like, yeah, Donnie, it was really embarrassing.
Yeah, like that's probably why Frank didn't call. But Frank lies and said it's because he was like too ashamed. The writing here is so annoying. He's like, well, I was out there taking drugs off the street. Jill was putting it up her nose, smoking it, popping pills, whatever.
I know. Okay. Like, am I supposed to feel bad for you or her after that sentence?
So he admits he made it all about himself. And Cragen, unprompted, brings up the fact that... So, again, the dialogue is so irritating because Frank is like, yeah, I really made this about myself. And Cragen's like, you saved my life one time. Yeah, okay, but I'm trying to tell you something.
You know what? After I saw that video with Jill, I would have said, sorry, my guy, like...
You're, like, that whole family soup. I would have been mean to her, too. The wife's annoying, Frank's annoying, and Jill's annoying.
Oh, my God, wait. Have you seen the Gale the Snail episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
Not in a really long time.
Guys, Jill is Gale the Snail, okay? She's basically like Gale, like, I'm a woman now, Mom. I do drugs. All I want to do whenever I see Jill is salt her.
It does kind of make me laugh because Frank's kind of not buying whatever Cragen's selling. He's just like, if you have a question to ask, just ask me. Cragen's like, did you ever abuse Jill? No. Frank, okay, so Frank never hit her, but he did call her like a junkie loser. And he's like, that is abuse, right? And Cragen's like, yeah.
What about his wife? Is she not going, are they really going to sit here and pretend that Mrs. Foster was a hostage?
I think she was the instigator. Honestly, he's a cop. He probably knows better than this. I bet she was like, aren't you a man, Frank? Aren't you a man? A real man would go down to the internet and make that man tell us where she is. Aren't you a man, Frank? And he's like, I am a man.
Mom, there's an open bottle of Kettle One in the shower. Oh my God, what are you doing with the knife, Mom? Get in the car, Get Tim. The car. We're gonna find Jill.
She's the real villain, and I'll die on that hill. Well, it really is easier when I hate the episode. So even though he doesn't fucking deserve it, Cragen's like, I'll talk to Cabot and see if she can work something out. I'm like, work out what? He held hostages. There's nothing she can do.
There's literally nothing. And then the things he tries to appeal with are so useless. He's like, this is a cop. He's good a cop. It's a cop's daughter.
So was Lloyd. Lloyd was a cop.
Yeah, they didn't care about Lloyd. I would argue on behalf of Lloyd, actually, because...
He, too, was a beaten man.
He was a beaten. Beaten with a steel frying pan.
Oh, my God. Frank says this isn't about him. It's about Jill. And he begs Cragen to find her.
Ugh.
Dun, dun. So Funch are at the Stanton Apartments, where they wake up a just scruffy-looking doorman who is just napping away on a sofa. Just now, drunk. Unlike you, I don't have a doorman, but I don't think they're supposed to do that.
No, this would be... be very, very weird.
Now, he's one of the few characters I like in this episode because he's fucking hilarious, but...
I'm going to let it slide. It kind of works in this ridiculous universe that we're existing in called October 2000.
So they ask him where Lance Kanick lives, and he's like, well, he doesn't live here. Munch flashes his badge and says this is Kanick's last known address. And so the doorman explains that there are 46 apartments, but 48 mailboxes, and Kanick rents one of the extras. Is that common?
I don't know. That's, like, so dangerous.
Yeah, that seems sketchy. Except maybe we're supposed to believe this is a sketchy apartment because they have, like, the world's shittiest doorman. So he never picks up his own mail. A guy picks it up for him. And this doorman doesn't really know much else except that he drives a large SUV. Munch is like, what's the license plate number? Because he didn't learn in the last episode, even though it was not chronological. that people don't know license plate numbers. And the guy says that he's like, oh, yeah, that's my other hobby, memorizing license plate numbers. I don't know.
And Finn gets annoyed. He's like, I forget what he says, but he's like, meh, 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 meh. And I'm like, if someone did do this. Well,
they
lightly
threaten him with prison. That's what they do. I wrote, fellas, I don't know my own license plate number.
No,
I know
God,
half
no.
of it, but I don't know most of it.
I don't know. I don't have a car.
So the doorman sighs and tells them it's a dark green excursion. Finn asks if he gets much mail. And the doorman, who has been to this point not super helpful, is like, oh, yeah. He goes over and unlocks the guy's mailbox and is like, here's his mail. I was like, this is a first. Usually they're like, do you have a warrant for that?
I like how he has no issue intervening the sketchy guy who never picks up his own mail's like mail. He's like, yeah, here.
So Finn rifles through the mail and finds a bank statement from the Cayman Islands. So they're basically just like, oh, he's sketchy. That's all that means. So dun dun, we're back with Benson and Stabler, and they seem to be showing Jill's picture around like Central Park or something.
Yeah. Oh, it's Tompkins Square Park. I only know that because we walked through it and I was going to tell you that.
So they ask a man at like a lemonade stand if he recognizes the picture of Jill. He's like, oh, yeah, I saw her yesterday. He remembers her shirt, which is
a thread.
Kind of important, but not really. She was with some other kids, and he gestures to a group of youths a few yards away.
Hard quotations.
Yeah, youths, quote unquote.
Yeah, anytime we say the word youths, including reference to Jill herself, they're 30.
So Benson and Stabler start to mosey over to the youths and they're like, oh, no, the cops. And they kind of run, kind of hustle away. And we realize they were in the middle of talking to Tito. Benson picks up a fallen flyer for a rain light rave the following evening. And Tito explains that if you call the number on the flyer the day of the rave, they'll tell you where it is. I thought the youths had run away, but then they pan out and there's a group of youths right there, which I'm like, So where did they run away to? And also, this whole episode, they harp on not wanting to blow Tito's cover, but Tito's always with them and always talking to them.
I wrote that. I was like, it's so weird that they are using him for a very, like, you know, obvious, dodgy reason. And he's just always out in the open talking to them, like shamelessly
Like friendly.
Yeah.
So Stabler asks Tito if the youths recognize Jill, and Tito says no, but these kids know Canic. They buy ecstasy from him, and if they can't pay, they barter. Stabler's like, barter what? And Tito's like, sex, what do you think?
Yeah, dude.
Aren't you an SVU detective?
He must be, like, on something this episode, because he doesn't care. He's not mentioning Maureen.
Oh,
he
doesn't give a shit.
No, he isn't even really, he barely talks, I've realized.
So out of nowhere, Tito goes, hey, Ronnie. And now we're watching from the perspective of Tito's what I'm going to call the bandana cam, but it's really hard to say, so I wish I hadn't gone with that.
Bandana cam.
So Tito approaches Ronnie and shows him Jill's picture, even though I thought these youths had all run away, but they're still fucking here. And he asks Ronnie if he recognizes her. And Ronnie's like, well, she looks like a lot of girls. I don't know what you want from me. But he does show the picture to his group of friends and asks if anyone has seen her. One youth sees the picture and instead of, you know, acting chill, maybe just kind of casually walking away, just fucking bolts. And Stabler runs after him, catches him by the shirt, and he's like, why the fuck did you run? And the kid's like, the girl in the picture, I think she's dead.
No, he wanted to get caught. It was kind of like Anna Faris in Scary Movie. She's like, ah!
You know when people run, but with their body first, like this?
Yes, he, like, flop ran away. He, like, looked at them in the eyes and then kind of, like, turned dramatically and just, like, flopped away. I thought of it in a lot of ways. It was like when Ed from Ed, Eddy ran. It was a lot
of... Oh, yes.
Yeah. And then he's like, nothing. It's like you wanted to get caught. Snitch.
Well, dun-dun, this snitch takes them to, like, I guess, like, some sketchy abandoned building. SVU's all about the sketchy abandoned buildings. And I'm like, I thought New York had a housing crisis. Where are all these abandoned buildings?
This scene could have been cool. If the rest of this episode had been cool, the scene would have been cool.
Yeah, because like they kind of like roll into this like scary abandoned building. But it's during the day. So I feel like that almost makes it more scary because it's like dim in the building. And they're stepping on like broken glass and needles. And then they come across this... part that's just like filled with lady mannequins.
like top to 20, bottom. Yeah.
20
like,
to 30 lady mannequins, all naked.
They're like everywhere. They're like kind of wading through a sea of lady mannequins.
And then, wah, wah, one of the mannequins isn't a mannequin. It's a dead girl. Is it Jill? No.
I couldn't remember at first. I was like, is it?
Well, they don't answer you right away. No, you're like, no. Oh, my God. They're like, oh, shit. And then I'm like, well, did they find Jill? I think it takes like several seconds into the next scene for them to be like, oh, yeah, it wasn't Jill. Well, dun dun. We're back with IAB and now they're interviewing Stabler and it comes out that the body wasn't Jill. The agents ask if her death affected the investigation. So Stabler's like, well, it intensified. This is the first scene with the IAB agents where it's only we're seeing them from basically the chest down. So they're basically just a bunch of headless bodies giving Stabler the business. So they're giving him the business for spending all this time chasing after this one runaway when there are many others and for getting a civilian, Tito, involved in this whole situation. Valid points across the board. Yeah, so it's closing in on Stabler's face and the agents are asking increasingly more intense questions, specifically about registering Tito as a confidential informant, which they did not do.
He's like, and then I forget who he said. He was like COD or whatever. I was like, what? He's like, that person knew. And I'm like, who?
They're just like rattling off words. And this is why I hated this episode.
Right. And it doesn't mean anything. Like, they're basically just being like, you didn't follow process or protocol. And once again, had no authority to do this. And he's like, stop pointing out. Stop making good points.
Well, back to the past. Hey, Emmy Lance Reddick is here with the deceased runaway.
R.I.P.
He tells the detectives that she's approximately 14 years old and she OD'd on a bunch of drugs that are usually found at raves. I love that he like rattles off, you know, like ecstasy and like a few other ones. And he's like, usually found at raves. And I was like, raves. We know. Dr. Lance Reddick ordered an MRI because the girl had been so seriously abused and he found that she had fractures all over her body. And he was, in fact, so shaken by her condition that he tells Benson and Stabler that if her body's unclaimed, he is happy to pay for her funeral, which is very nice.
It makes my body hurt.
Sorry, guys. Furthermore, her entire body was waxed besides her hair and eyebrows. I'm sorry. That's gross. So dun-dun, Cragen and Cabot are watching the boy from earlier being interviewed. This one's another one where I was like, what the fuck is happening?
His telling of it was weird.
Basically, what I know is happening, but I think what this kid is trying to say is that he's part of a group of kids that are kind of being trafficked by these weird shadowy adults that are like showing up at all these raves. Like, they don't have any money, so...
Yeah. Coercing them to do things because they have drugs.
In this specific kid's scenario, some person who he wouldn't recognize the face of drove them in a car somewhere that he can't identify, and the lights were in his face, so he never saw anything. He just heard voices. And the voices were like, do him, do her.
And then Cragen comes over and is like, wow, he's super unhelpful. Because at this point, Cragen doesn't give a shit about anyone but Jill. Also, again, this is what happens when you cast whole adult people to be teenagers, because it's hard to feel bad for this kid when he's like, and then the first is, do him, do her. I is sad, but I'm like looking at a 27-year-old while he's
saying. Well, no, he doesn't seem sad. He's like, yeah, then they were like, oh, yeah, do him, do her. He seems more upset that the girl died than he does about the whole sex for drugs situation.
Yeah, and then you might have already said this, but they're like, how did you know that girl that they found in, among the mannequin bottoms? And he was like, just some girl who was at the rave.
Yeah, like, this kid literally has no information. So I think he probably does get into a lot of trouble, and Cragen doesn't care because it's not... Jill Foster is his Maureen.
Yeah, no, we have traded... We'll take your Maureen, but we're going to give you the Jill Foster.
He does ask Cabot if they can use a new date rape drug law to charge the people that gave them the drugs. And Cabot's like, yeah, if you can find the people.
Oh, yeah, I guess because it's like they agreed to take drugs, but not those types of drugs.
And Cragen's like, we need Jill Foster. And Cabot's like, I'd prefer a sober witness.
Yeah, she's like, okay, your Jill Foster's still not shit. We'll use my friend, Jill Foster. And you're like, the fucking strung out drug addict? I don't want her painting my barn.
So Cragen suggests they can bring in Jill Foster's brother. But I don't know why, because they're like, oh, we need someone with details. And I'm like, but why does Timmy have details?
All of Cragen's ideas are bad this episode.
Oh, he's so dumb this episode.
He's like, get his brother. He's going to help. And I'm like, no, I think we've already established that the Fosters are a stupid breed.
And furthermore, if they were searching for Jill Foster, why wouldn't they have interviewed the family first and been like, hey, did she say where she was going? Like, they're like, oh, hey, now that we're in this weird convoluted case involving someone filming minors in sex acts, why don't we bring in Jill Foster's brother? I'm like, what? Why didn't you talk to him already? So now Jeffries is interviewing Jill Foster's brother and she's like, did Jill use drugs? And I'm like, I thought we established that when Frank Foster called her a stupid junkie or whatever the fuck he said to her.
Yeah, and when she was strung out talking about not being able to wear purple lipstick.
So fucking her brother goes, she'd drop X just to get through dinner. I thought ecstasy made you not hungry.
So I'm an idiot and I was like, did he mean Xanax? Why are you taking ecstasy at dinner?
Why are you taking a club drug at home?
That's the least fun way to
moron.
Do
it. Moron. She asks if Jill has any special interests, and he's basically like, no, she's just a stupid, dumb girl who likes drugs. But he's like, oh, and maybe art. So Jeffries asks if she ever talked about running away, and he's like, yeah, but I thought she'd go to Disney World because she was always talking about going to see Dumbo.
How?
This kid is a Dumbo. So, dun-dun, back in the bullpen, Cragen asks for his special rundown, and Jeffries tells him that they need to look for Jill and Dumbo. And he has to do some exposition here. He's like, why the arts district?
Yeah,
well,
thanks.
That's for rubes like me who live in New Hampshire. And Jeffries like, well, her brother didn't know that Dumbo stands for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass. He was thinking cartoon.
Oh, and in case you're wondering, is this her older or younger brother? We don't know. And it's like visually ambiguous.
He could be 14. He could be 25. He acts like he's 14, so I'm really unsure. So Cragen asks about the Jane Doe, and Olivia tells him that she died by an overdose. And Finn chimes in that her name was Gina Lang from D.C. Her parents seem very concerned with the cost of shipping her body. Sad. Cragen asks if they can tie Canuck to any of this, and Munch tells him that they can't even freaking find Canuck. He has no address, no license, and an offshore bank account. But Jeffries chimes in to say he's tied to Rainlight Raves. Oh, I should say, so they use the terms Rainlight Raves and Rainlight Production kind of interchangeably. So the attorney on record for this company is named Ted Bolger, and he's the lawyer Canuck used for his murder case. Interesting. So Cragen sends Benson and Stabler to Dumbo, and Funch are sent to interview Bolger. So Funch roll into Bolger's office as he is in the middle of snorting a fat line off his desk. So Ted Bolger is played by Daryl Hammond, who is famous for his long tenure in SNL. He, in fact, used to have like the longest tenure on SNL until Kenan Thompson was like, hold this. So Daryl Hammond stands up and tells them to get the hell out of his office. It soon becomes very clear to us that Finn is immediately doing a bit and kind of puts on a whole like, I'm a gangster situation. And Finn's like, yeah, I'm going to tell them about all that cocaine in your desk. Finn then is like, what's your rate? And then just kind of like rains some dollar bills.
$600 an hour.
Why does he have like $600 on him? So Finn gives him his card that simply just says Finn on it. And he says he tells him some lie that he has some girls he wants to put to work. He's kind of pretending he's a pimp. Bolger gives him Canuck's number and tells him that in Canuck's line of work, it's better if Bolger doesn't know where he is, but they can call Canuck and kind of get hooked up with him. Outside, Munch is on the phone passing along Canuck's number. And then when he hangs up, he's like, dude, what the hell was that? Like, what were you doing in there? He basically says, you can't do this cowboy shit in SVU. I know, like, that's what you guys would do to narcotics, but this is SVU. So now we're at a flea market in Dumbo, and some burnout hippie lady is looking at a photo of Jill that Liv is showing her, and she's like, oh, man, I liked her t-shirt. I wanted to train her, but she wouldn't give it up. So this was 2 hours ago, and she refers to Jill as one of those candy kids. And Tito's like, fuzzy clothes, plastic jewelry. Is it? Is that what they're wearing?
Maybe club clothes, like fuzzy tops and stuff, like, you know.
Like, there is a fuzzy hat in the next scene. So Tito helpfully, I always forget Tito is there. and he suddenly like will appear. And then another character who's straight out of central casting pops up to say that the kids are headed over to Lorna Frankel's loft. Liv asks who Frankel is, and the hippie's like, think of Salvador Dali's feminine side, then give it fangs. I hate this episode.
Lady's very annoying, and those people still exist in Brooklyn to this very fucking day.
Well, dun dun. So it's kind of funny that, like, Benson and Stabler just got this info, but then Funch are the ones that kind of arrive at Lorna Frankel's loft. There are, again, youths, quote unquote, read like 30-year-olds, yeah, everywhere doing weird shit. They're like petting each other and like painting each other. And
they're just like on acid and like, yeah, covered in paint. A lot of them are wearing outfits that the art students and fashion students here wear now. So full circle. There's one girl in a pink outfit who absolutely slays.
So they make their way through the youths until they find Frankel in the back, and she's projected like an abstract watercolor painting on her wall and is kind of outlining it. Ugh, I feel like it's supposed to be very like, oh, she paints on her walls. Lorna is one of those bohemian looking women that dress 20 years too young. Like, she looks like she's in her 40s, and I'm being generous, but she's wearing like a tight fitted ripped red shirt and body glitter.
I actually liked her, except for she's a bad person, obviously. So, like, I wrote that in my notes. I'm like, I really want to like Lorna, but I just know she's
up to no good.
She's probably a human trafficker. What with all these juveniles, as they refer to them later, the tallest juveniles I've ever seen.
I guess she thinks Funch are there to shoot a porno.
Yeah, she was very disappointed upon seeing them, and I would have been too for this. She was like, oh God, this is who they sent.
She's like, okay, well, I guess get in there and take your clothes off. And they're like, So Munch takes out his badge, and he's like, who the hell are all these kids? And she's like, they just wander in. So Munch asks if Jill Foster wandered in, and she's like, well, if she did, she'd be here. Tito stands up from where he has been talking to a gentleman in a fuzzy hat and says Jill left an hour ago. Tito's the only one who's doing, like, real police work.
I really liked Tito.
So they ask Frankel where she would have gone, and she kind of gives them guff. And at that point, they're like, all right, we're done playing nice, I guess. So they round up gaggle of heathens.
Yeah. And then Lorna, who's been arrested a time or two, is, like, giving them tips. She's like, don't tell them you're real. Or she's like, tell them who you are, but don't tell them anything else. Stand up straight. Keep your chins
just
high.
Like, thanks, mama drugs. Right. On the streets, BNS meet up with a cop who pulled over a car registered to Rainlight Productions. It's promotions. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's promotions.
So on the streets, BNS meet up with a cop who was pulled over a car registered to Rainlight Promotions. He tells them the driver is clean. And then they kind of like look in the back, and Liv has Canuck, who's sitting back there, step out. And then she proudly tells him they tracked him using his cell phone. I was like, shut up. What if you want to track him later?
Right? Damn.
So Benson asks for his address, and he finally tells her that he's living at the Biltmore. She asks him where Jane Foster is. Like this guy gives a shit what any of these kids' names are. So then Stabler kind of like puffs up his chest. He's like, yeah, there's 39,000 of us. If anything happens to her, we're all going to want a piece of you.
Ew.
So Canuck's like, yeah, whatever. Takes their card and gets back in his car.
So annoying. Bye. Yeah. I'm so rooting annoying. For exactly no one, except for maybe a little Lorna.
Well, dun dun. The youth are at the station, and they are on their worst behavior. They come, like, galloping in, like they're on horses, and they literally, one girl cups her hand around her mouth and shouts in the face of a, like, officer in uniform who's just standing there who looks like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And they're just like, ooh.
Oh, they were 1,000%, like, theater kids, because, you know, like, in plays,
I write
they do
that later!
Yes, because they do
it.
That.
They are just hooting, hollering, causing a scene. Cragen rushes over, and he's like, John, what the hell?
He's like, you couldn't have questioned them back there? And Finn was like, and Lorna was giving them cues, and I'm just picturing her being like, fix your hair. They ask you about the drugs, tell them what it is, but not that it's yours.
Smile, baby, you're a star. So they have, like, Monique herd them away into a room, and she's like, guys, calm down, this is not a club. Cragen hauls Funch into his office to be like, what the absolute hell, you've blown it, because now word's gonna get out that you're looking for Jill. Your detective Benson just basically pulled over a guy in a car, told him how they found him, and was like, and where's Jill Foster? She's a cop's daughter. This is what she looks like. Can we find her? What is he talking about?
Perhaps this is the origin of where they decided to, he decided to like turn the other cheek about the undercover of it all, because I bet Finn was like, yeah, that's why I had to go in and pretend to be some rando drug dealer at this lawyer's office. Because it is like the subtle exchange to we're 1,000% undercover, and then Cragen being like, I don't know when this happened. It's like,
and then he lets them all do it.
Yeah.
They're like, Finn got to pretend to be someone. Why can't we?
It's definitely like it was showcasing Finn's skill sets, which none of them have. We later see.
So Munch notices Bulger hustling in and he's like, oh, and also this guy thinks Finn's a gangster. And Cragen is like, OK, so you did undercover without clearance. Poor Cragen's like sweating.
But it was only a little bit. Like it was
only
really
a little bit of undercover.
It was a smidge. Bit. And I think we and again, I maintain my argument was we couldn't go in there and be like, hey, this is the cops and we're looking for Lance Reddick.
I would say at least when dealing with a lawyer, it's better to pretend not to be cops.
And this guy is like doing cocaine off his desk. So. Yeah.
Cragen peeks into the nice interrogation room to see Bulger proudly telling the youths he's their attorney.
And they all cheer.
Oh, they do. They're all like, yay.
I forget what he says to them, but he goes in. He's like, don't say another word. I'm your attorney. And they're all like, hooray.
Hooray. And he's like, how did they get here so fast? So Munch tells him that Frankel is connected to Canik. And then Monique escorts Tito into the room, which I'm like, guys, Bulger is right there, and I don't know why. This is just a mess. This is such a mess.
This is chaos. This is the Stabler family dinner table.
So Munch tells him that Frankel and Canik share a lawyer, and if Canik finds out Tito's helping them, Canik's going to kill him. They have not been subtle about Tito up to this point, but meanwhile, one of the youths is just pressing his face into the glass and like, fucking around while Cricken's talking.
I just know that man is from the Upper West Side.
I literally wrote, these youths are like high school theater kids who have been told to act like they're rolling on ecstasy.
I won't say they understood the assignment.
No, because they didn't. So Tito is told to lay low, and Cragen orders the kids be released.
The kids. It cracks me up.
They're all like at least 25.
I know we do this, or I do this in particular, every single time, but like it's getting worse with every passing episode. Like I kept forgetting. I'm like, why are we upset about these people doing drugs? Like they're grown ass adults in their 30s who probably abandoned their young children to be here. But they're like, no, the juveniles.
The 14-year-olds. So Cragen enters the room and Bulger just gives him shit. He's like, hey guys, yeah, sorry. We're just like looking for someone. And Bulger's like, I don't care. If you were looking for Osama bin Laden, you're trampling on these kids' rights. And the kids are like, yeah!
He's like, who wants to go back to my office and have sex with me? Do cocaine.
So Cragen makes his way back to Munch and he's like, what were you guys thinking? He's big mad and he basically is like, you two need to stop fucking around. So back to the present, it's Liv's turn with IAB. And again, we don't see their faces. And this line of questioning is all about who authorized the undercover work at the rave. And she doesn't know. She's like, I don't know. Cragen said it was okay, so I figured it was fine.
She's so defensive.
They like fish and push her, but she just like is like, well, I don't. She basically is like, I don't know anything. Cragen said it was okay, so it must have been fine.
Yeah, she's like, you trying to go after my captain? And they're like, We're trying to
get to the bottom of, like, this absolute shit show that was your case. They're like, did you guys even have a plan? And she's like, yeah, we had a full tactical plan.
When?
Actually, so my favorite part of this scene is they're like, okay, well, your plan was clearly flawed. And she looks very serious and she goes, some things you can't foresee.
Some things you can't foresee.
I know. That delivery was fucking hilarious.
Well, lordy lordy, we're at this rave and Benson and Jeffries are undercover, looking like two narcs.
Olivia and Monique tried too hard. The men tried not at all. Stabler to the point where he's literally in his denim shirt.
Well, a moment for the outfits. I detail them. Liv is wearing a pink cami with like a bandana print, a pacifier around her neck and huge blue cargo pants with like sparkles on her face. Jeffries is wearing like a leopard print crop top with like a halter situation and a belly chain and like fake strands of colorful hair. She actually looks hot. So they're like making their way through the crowd and like people are offering them drugs and they're like, oh.
They keep cutting to like chaotic scenes like couples dancing against black light, not black lights, but you know, like silhouettes of them like almost kissing or grinding. And I'm like, this is a terrible, if someone brought me here, I'd be like, I'm leaving. I'm going to Dante's.
And the boys are all clustered together. So at first I didn't think they were undercover. And then I realized Stabler was like, I'm going to roll up the sleeves of my shirt and unbutton it a few buttons and I'm going to be undercover.
To reveal a tank top beneath it. Not even like his bare, that would have been more cunt of him. But like he just, it was like a regular shirt. I'm like, you guys are so clearly cops. It makes me physically ill.
They look like cops. Jeffries notices Tito being kind of like made by a security guard, like a security guard's like kind of looking at him like, So she like kind of dances her way over to him and she's like, what the fuck are you doing here? And he's like, I can handle myself.
Yeah, she's like, what happened to laying low? And it's like, what happened to laying low? Don't talk to him.
So intermingled with flashes of the rave, we see Frankel in the corner taking her creepy pictures. And finally, Stabler spots Jill. Do you think he quietly and casually makes his way over to her? No! He shouts her fucking name and gives her time to skedaddle the fuck out of there.
It was insane.
I was like, Stabler, what are you doing? As this is happening, Liv spots a rave goer being assaulted by two men as Frankel's kind of like taking pictures of the whole situation. So she calls her backup, flashes her badge, she breaks up the assault, and Stabler loses Jill as the squad arrests Frankel.
I remember that scene when I was watching as a kid, and I remember thinking it was so disturbing, like the guys trying to get the girl's pants off.
So, dun-dun, obviously we're in the mean interrogation room.
Yeah.
That was bad. Cabot arrives to talk to Frankel. She's like, I want my lawyer. It's been 12 hours.
She was really calm. I probably would have been angry if I had to wait 12 hours.
Well, I wonder if they're insinuating she's on drugs. So she's just been in there kind of like, woo!
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm so confused about, like, what the parameters are about asking for a lawyer. You know what I mean?
Because Cabot basically says no. She's like, write your lawyer, Ted Bolger. And Olivia, at that moment, enters the room with just a... At first, I thought it was a box of files, got excited, wrote a joke about it. But alas, it's just a box of evidence from Frankel's apartment. They have got pictures of minors engaged in sex acts and a waxing strip with Gina Lang's DNA on it.
Why did they have that?
How'd they get the results that quick? Okay, yeah. No, first, why were the strips there? But also, they're always like, oh my God, have we got the results yet? What are those results coming in? Really? They got these results in under 12 hours? Munch says that she used to be a porn princess named Layla Cream Cheese. And she used to be a sex worker. So due to her extensive rap sheet, Cabot thinks that she can get 7 years per sex act for all the minor, I wrote minor stuff, which I'm like, all the crimes about the minors. And then 15 for the death of Gina Lang, which would be in total 715 years. When they were first saying it, I was like, this math ain't mathin'.
And I know.
Like, no, they must mean like seven per act. So Cabot tells her that they know Kanick and Bolger both benefit from illegal enterprises to which they can only tie her. And Cabot wants to prove that Bolger is a partner in all of this. And if she can, Frankel will get a deal. So Frankel's like, as far as I know, Bolger is just a lawyer I'm supposed to call when something like this happens. But if you have all those videos from my loft, what you do have is Kanick. Because a few times when she was filming, she would just turn the camera around and get Kanick on tape. I guess for leverage? I don't know.
Yeah, I think she kind of, she sort of has the air of, well, I knew that. It was sort of like when Siobhan got caught. She was like, all right, jig's up. Yeah, I took some videos of him just in case. There you go. It's on the tapes. Whatever.
There you go.
I like how the lawyer thing was my favorite part because she's like, yeah, I want to call my lawyer, but if you already got him, forget it. Sorry, Cabot brings up to Lorna that Kanick killed a girl in like, 87
or whatever.
Wendy.
Sorry, Wendy.
Yeah, she goes, Wendy. She's like, yeah, Wendy. And again, that's when I really fell in love with Lorna and wish she wasn't a trafficker. I was like, oh my God, that's so funny. She's like,
that was really funny.
Wendy.
So Jeffries comes in and pulls Stabler out of the meeting and asks if he's Paige Tito. Stabler's like, yes, I have, three times. Uh-oh, I smell a Gina Silver award.
Well, and then did Monique go... homicide call? Was this her being like, he's dead?
Yeah, because Stabler goes, oh, did he finally call in? And Stabler's like, no, homicide. And I think she means like, no homicide called in.
Okay, I was...
Which is a weird way of saying it. I mean, I think for that, it's like the writing. They wanted it to sound like smooth, like, oh, did he call in? She's like, no, homicide. So on the streets, Stabler meets up with homicide detective Ed, and Ed had just been called to a scene and he was examining the body when he saw the pager go off and recognized Elliot's number. So Stabler goes to the body and pulls back the blanket, and yes, indeed, it is Tito. But as always, Tito was filming with his bandana cam. Dun dun. So back at the station, the squad reviews the tape and it shows Jill, who is distraught to learn her father's in jail. What'd you think was going to happen, Jilly?
She's like, it's my fault. And like, your dad's kind of crazy. No. Yeah, not really.
It's not really your fault.
Like, yeah, it's...
You didn't ask your dad to go hold hostages.
You didn't have to do all that you're doing just to do drugs. I'll give you that. Like, it is a little your fault because normal people, especially normal kids in Manhattan, would just fucking casually do drugs. And you're doing a lot, Jill. But your dad's also to blame here.
So Tito's like, no, you can fix this. And she's like, no, I can't. Apparently, after Tito pulled her out of the rave, she went looking to score ecstasy. And when she didn't have any money, she allowed probably Canik and Lorna to take pictures of her. And now she's afraid that if she comes in, the detectives are going to show her dad the pictures. Tito, deadass, goes, no, they won't. They're my friends.
Oh, that made me so sad.
That made me laugh because I was like, what? They're friends?
Well, they didn't, like, do anything to protect him. So it's like, again, like, they're like, oh, yeah, no, we'll just, like, use somebody as an informant.
Again.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of informant work here, which is, they're horrible at that. We have no good examples of this so far.
They've gotten so many people killed now.
Yes. I'm like, stop doing informant work.
Who do we have? Tito, and we have Mrs. What's her face from Honor.
Yes.
Who's more?
And Baby Killer, the little boy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He got Gina Silvered.
Yeah, he got like hardcore Gina Silvered. That was this season. Again, informant work. They brought him to the fucking machete store with a little mask on. They're like, don't worry, he's not going to know it's you.
Don't worry, you're gonna have a mask that's a pig with a top hat.
Yeah.
Fine. So Tito promises her that her dad will never see the photos. Her family really wants to see her. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And he's like, well, where are you staying? And she basically says it's like a creepy place, but she's glad to have a roof.
I could never be on the streets.
No, I'm ever. Like, I sometimes can't sleep over people's houses because I'm like, I just want to be home in my bed.
Oh, I don't like, I have a huge issue staying at people's houses if they don't have proper curtains. Some people just willy-nilly. They're like, here's my guest room. There aren't any curtains. I'm like, what the fuck? You want,
seriously?
Yeah, I'm on the ground floor. You want your creepy neighbor or like anyone to just like look in? You want me to be kidnapped? Now that I'm thinner, it's easier to lift me.
You're more easily kidnapped.
I'm a little quieter, so I can't even yell as loud. So if I got kidnapped and carried away, I'd get fatigued. I'm so little.
So little.
That's why he's taking me. He saw me and he was
she's so little, I'm gonna take her.
I need to save her. So little. Put her in a little box.
So then, sorry, I was like, oh no, my
legs. I'm not sorry for anything we've said here.
So then we hear a gunshot and Jill shrieks, but not as loudly as I would have if someone was just shot in front of me, but that's her. She just goes, ah, and runs away. So after a moment, Canik comes into frame and conveniently shows his face and gives his motive for the hit. He's like, bring the cops down on my rave. You brought this on yourself. And then Canik kind of shakes him and is like, cold yet? And then he walks away as blood pools on the ground.
Yeah, it was a really creepy like moment. Again, a lot of potential here. Like, that was a good scene, but
that was actually probably one of the better scenes besides Jill.
Yeah, because that'd be like a really, like, you're dying and someone goes, are you cold yet? Damn.
So I kind of like Canik, but I won't say that yet.
I know. I kind of like Lorna. I'm like, ah, man. First thing I saw her and I'm like, I like this broad. Pretty sure she's a human trafficker.
Oh, wow.
She kind of like is and isn't. Like, she's like, I will neither confirm nor deny that I know the ages of these juveniles. Listen, justice for Lorna. I don't think she knew these people were juveniles because they don't look like juveniles.
They don't. don't. It's not her fault. And she just, like, leaves her apartment open and people walk in. It's not like she goes out and gets them.
If anything, this is elder abuse. Lorna is, at the very minimum, 80 years old. And these street youths are just coming in and using her beautiful loft as a flop house. And all she's trying to do is create art.
I mean, she has a loft in Dumbo. It's probably pretty, well, maybe then it wasn't expensive, but now that loft would probably be like $1 million a month.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, I think Lorna is just misunderstood, as we can see by her clothing. You know, she grew up probably in Minnesota, and she was Leah Cream Cheese for a while, and I don't think it's fair, and I think these kids have some splaining to do.
Leah Cream Cheese. So, back to the present, I guess. IAB is like, how was the mood after Tito was killed? And Cabot's like, tense?
Yeah, no one liked it.
I wrote here that I'm so tired of these scenes. They essentially want Cabot to say this is all Cragen's fault, and she's like, the squad acted in a professional manner. I'm not gonna say that. Which, did they, Cabot? Did they really? Did they?
They make it worse, too, because at this point I might have been like, okay, they were a little overzealous over a person they thought was being trafficked. But then they just double down.
Well, dun-dun, back to the past. Cabot and Stabler bring Kanik into the mean interrogation room and show him the video of him murdering Tito. Cabot's just kind of like casually talking to Stabler. She's like, yeah, I can't wait to give this guy the death penalty. It's going to be so funny. And then I just know the day he gets murked by our state, someone's going to call me and be like, oh, please don't do it. And I can't wait to take that call. And Kanik's like, I will literally tell you anything you want to know. What's good.
Yeah. He's like, again, I'm kind of like, well, and then I forgot he actually killed someone. I'm like, he didn't really do all that much because these are not children as far as I'm concerned.
Cabot's like, I can't do anything for you. You called your lawyer. He's like, yeah, literally forget all that. What do you want? She's like, I want evidence that Bulger's your... I don't know why they're so hung up on getting Bulger, who to this point we've only just see do a little cocaine.
Well, I'm guessing, so you could tell me if I'm wrong here. It's all because of the trafficking shit, right? So they're lightly trafficking. I don't know if we've made it really clear, but
because the episode didn't,
right? So the TLDR and this whole thing is these two are trafficking these juveniles, and by way of like they're showing up to these raves where it is supposed to be a sober, that's another thing I was going to say earlier, is that a lot of these raves are supposed to be sober culture, but like I don't know how much they really are, but like just like get high on life. So they show up to these sober raves, get the kids into the drugs by offering it to them, and then they're hooked, and then when they need more they're like, oh, I don't have money, and then they're like, okay, well you can like hump each other on camera for us and we're gonna sell them to like pervs.
Which they, it's so funny, they never say the words trafficked in this whole episode,
right?
Which so is I what mean, they're doing. She tells Kanik that she wants evidence that Bulger's his partner, and if he gives that to her she will go for life without parole. Panic's like, absolutely not. Man one, 15, and I'll give you Bulger and that girl Jill. And Cabot's like, no dice, my deal or the death penalty.
Yeah.
And she's like, you've got 10 minutes.
The three of us, right? The three of us are all like, absolutely fucking not. You're not getting out in 15 years. You killed a girl.
Oh, yeah.
There's no fucking way you're getting out in 15 years when you would be, he's not a very old man, like he would be old enough to do this again. Like what's he supposed to do? Then he's institutionalized, he's supposed to go and get a regular job after 15 fucking anyway.
So Paige and I being very logical right now, of course not. Of course this man must have life in prison. So we go into Cragen's office and he is furious. He's like, this is a cop's child. Like everyone in the room, Munch, Finn, Liv, and
everyone,
Elliot are just dogpiling her. They're like, how could you do this? This is a cop's child. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean? Literally, at one point, they kind of threaten her. And they're like, you know what? If you can't play ball, I don't know if we can really trust you. And she's like, are you fucking threatening me?
It's so weird. And then when she says, like, basically everything we just said, you can't let him out in 15 years or 20 years. Like, that would be insane. He's a... I mean, up until this point, I've been arguing that I don't know what he did wrong because he's been working with a bunch of 40-year-olds. But, like, in this world called October 2000, they're supposed to be teenagers that he's exploited and trafficked and, like, drugged and menaced. And he killed one named Wendy.
And now two women are dead because of him.
Oh, yeah. Gina and Emmy Reddick said that this girl's body was so badly beaten that he wants to personally know what happened. You know what I mean? Like, all this really shitty shit. And one of them, I think it's Cragen, fixes his mouth to say to Cabot, we can't concern ourselves with a hypothetical murder 20 years down the line. That is why you hand out life sentences.
100%. I actually was so pissed at his line that I wrote it down. We can save a life today, not prevent some hypothetical murder 20 years down the road. And he says it so snottily to her.
That's something I'd expect to come from Sophie's mother's mouth. That's basically what Sophie's mom, she was like, listen, I don't know what you want me to do. That little girl that's currently missing is not my daughter. And so I don't fucking care.
I don't care. And literally, if this was anybody else, like not Jill, they would totally agree with Alex. And it's because she's a coworker's kid. They're just like, fuck you, Alex. And she actually gets so pissed at them that she's like, she's literally like, yeah, whatever. And she leaves. She's like, fuck all of you.
It's insane. I felt like very gaslit by the writers because I, at least one of them is usually, one of the squad is usually arguing both sides. I was so disappointed in everyone being like, 20 years from now, not going to be our fucking problem. Actually, it will be because you're still going to be solving crimes around
Guess
then.
What, Olivia? Well, so the funny thing is, in the very next scene, Munch and Finn are outside and it's kind of like, I guess, the area where they take people who are at the police station before they take them to prison for the night. Because they're kind of like chilling in this area. And Munch basically says to Finn, he's like, you know what, Cabot's actually totally right.
Yeah, I was going to say fucking finally. But like he definitely didn't. He was arguing on their behalf, right?
No, because there was nobody in the room who like was defending Alex.
Yeah, so he's just a fake ass bitch.
Now, Finn coyly says to Munch, they're like, you know, we totally could get this info out of Kanik. And Munch is like, yeah, we don't do that shit here. And Finn's like, yeah, but what if we did?
Yeah, this is so clearly, if we didn't know now we know that this was filmed earlier because he's being like, why don't we beat him up? But first of all, we've seen him do that a couple of times recently, so clearly no one cares anymore. But second of all, he's being like, yeah, guys, we'll just like go ahead and do some undercover work and like no one's going to find out. And now he's like, yeah, we'll just do some light police brutalities. No one's going to find out. Fine.
So like two cops look like they're already taking Kanik, and then Munch goes, hey, you know what, like we'll take him, but I feel like that's got to be paperwork. So we see Finn take Kanik and Munch gets in the front seat, and then Finn kind of smacks Kanik's head like into the like hood, not the hood, he's like,
I called it the car top.
The car.
It's because it's the roof of the car, but I always think of that as inside.
Yeah. So he,
I know it's not.
He like smacks Kanik's head like against the car as he's like putting him in, and then gets in the back seat with him, which I don't think you were supposed to do either.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
So cut to Finn with IAB, and he's like, you know, it was so weird. Mysteriously on the way to booking, Kanik just kind of like told us where Jill Foster was. It was so weird, you guys. Super weird.
Kind of a blink and you'll miss it type of weird.
They're like, yeah, that was weird. And then you like beat him up so he told you. And he's like, what?
They didn't like say he sustained injuries, so they're like, you beat him up.
It literally just kind of turns into like a he said, she said. And Finn's kind of like, yeah. Are you going to believe me, a decorated cop, or that piece of crap? So back in the past, Funch pull up to their destination, and as Finn hauls off Kanik, Munch gets on the phone and he's like, yep, Kanik gave us the info we needed. Dun dun. So Benson and Stabler arrive at an undisclosed, sketchy location, and they're like shining their flashlights around, calling for Jill. When Olivia calls her people, she always makes, I don't know why it's so funny. She's like, Jill, your parents want to see you, Jill. Jill. They're just like, I don't know. She's such a dork sometimes.
And this is overlaid with Finn now lecturing IAB about, like, Jill being a child in danger and like, basically a victim in all this. And, like, Jill didn't want to do drugs or porn. She was forced to. And the whole time I'm like, So no one. Oh, and then I think they say something about her dad. They're like, you know, and a good cop is now in jail. And, like, so no one's going to take any accountability.
Yeah, no. This episode will be called No Accountability. They're shining their lights around, and eventually they land on like this pile of boxes, and beyond the boxes is a dirty mattress that Jill is laying upon with candles lit around her. Like, she lit some candles for ambiance before she shot up some heroin.
Just when we thought Jill couldn't be any stupider, she lit candles surrounded by cardboard boxes.
But this was Jill's very last mistake because she is dead.
She OD'd.
This whole episode was for nothing. So, dun dun. Cragen is in his office and Munch arrives to tell him that Frank Foster has arrived. And Cragen goes into the mean interrogation room where Frank Foster is sitting. And you can't hear what they say because the writers were like, we're so bad at our jobs, we're just not going to write any dialogue for this.
I think at this point they kind of had a feeling the audience doesn't care what Frank Foster has to say about this.
It's like one of those scenes where Cragen like says something and then Frank just like puts his head down like, wow, I ruined my whole life and I have another child at home and I didn't think twice before holding a man hostage. And now that man's dead and it's all because of my stupid idiot daughter. So we end with Cragen in IAB's office and they're like, hey, we have some serious concerns about all the shit you did wrong. They kind of like go through the list. They're like, you did undercover work without authorization. You got an informant killed. Fucking the girl's dead. Like, what the fuck? And Cragen gets up on his high horse and is basically like, oh, you all you guys care about is Canik when really Jill Foster was the victim and now she's dead. I wish I'd written down the last line because it's really just his dick ass bitching these people out about what a piece of crap Canik is and how they only care about his rights. But Jill Foster was the real victim. And he's like, I don't care what you do to me. And also the punishment for all of this is literally just docking him 5 vacation days.
That's it. Yeah. Which on both sides, it's kind of like, why was IAB making such a big deal when all it was docking 5 vacation days?
I thought he was going to get fired, which I think he should be fired, actually.
This was so annoying because they're just patently wrong about all of this. And I'm taking this stance. I understand addiction's a disease, but at some point you've got to take accountability for yourself. We were both 16.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not to do stuff like that. You can also do drugs without putting everyone you know at risk by dealing with like people who are making porn and stuff. Like, she just did everything wrong and they did not want to admit that she was just fucking herself up.
Yeah.
Her dying, I tried to rationalize. I was like, well, maybe they're trying to insinuate that she like was killed, like, you know, again, a la Taken, like they shot her up with bad drugs to like shut her up or whatever. But that's not it. They were literally taking the stance of like, she was the victim of circumstance. She was a child lost to these things. Like, these adults failed her. And, like, she failed her fucking self.
I did wonder if, at one point, if they were trying to insinuate that Canik killed her with the heroin. Because at one point when he's having a back and forth with Cabot, she says something like, lethal injection. And he goes back like, heroin. And I was like, is he...
Oh, so...
Was that him being like, oh, she's going to die from doing heroin. So, like...
I think so. I took that as a threat, like, yeah, being like that or you lose a girl to heroin addiction.
And I just don't understand. So the whole time they're chasing Jill, I'm like, literally every single youth they're running into is in the same situation she is. So why is she so fucking special?
And they do kind of reiterate, this is a cop's daughter, so it's in the family. Everyone knows about this.
Yeah, all they did was, like, call for Jill. And I'm like, she's in no more trouble than the rest of these kids that you're all just, like, hauling in for questioning and not trying to help. And really, the true focus of them, the true focus for them should have been to try to, like, shut down this whole trafficking ring. But they were so hyper-focused on Jill. Whereas if they had actually gone through the case normally, like they were actually trying to bust up a trafficking ring, they would have found her more quickly.
Yes. And it's a weird juxtaposition. I think you said this to me in a voice memo. Okay. Who else would she have said it to? And why would you know about it?
I was telling Tyler and you listened and you're like, you're right. That's a great point. From under my bed, you're like,
2025 goals. Oh my God. Please get your thought out, Paige. Oh, okay. No, sorry. Juxtapose with last week's episode,
yes,
where the stakes were so high, where like there were some funny things that happened, but we almost were kind of like, oh, I don't mean to point out this funny thing being that the stakes are very high, you know, and we even said this would be the shittiest 4 days of my life, because you just know you're waiting for this girl to be assaulted because that's like day three, and then day four or whatever, she's murdered. This one, the stakes weren't high at all, because everything we saw of Jill was all like her. And again, I'm not saying it's good, but the way that they wrote it out and the way that it played out on my television screen, it was sort of like, hey, pretty girl, you want to do some drugs? Okay, you don't have to if you don't want to. But if you do, you could make $500 at this party. Totally optional.
Totally optional. And she's like, okay.
I mean, unless I missed it. She wasn't like, oh, and then they held a gun to my head. Or I saw what they did to Gina and I didn't want my ribs to get broken. Gina, to remind everybody, is the dead mannequin person. And it's every kid that they've met is going, oh, no, you have to do it. Or Canik beats the tar out of you. Like, you have to. Like, his beatings are the worst. That would make sense. But they were like, yeah, Jill voluntarily did all of this.
And I kept forgetting how bad Canik was, because they did, to me, they didn't drive home enough. They never even said that he's the one who beat Gina.
Yeah, you're right.
It's only in retrospect that I'm like, oh, yeah, he's probably the one who beat up Gina.
Oh, my God, you're right. They never explicitly say. They say that he killed Wendy.
Wendy.
I bet Wendy was annoying. That's kind of the way she was like, oh, Wendy. Oh, yeah. I bet Wendy talked a lot.
And they kept trying to talk about all this danger Jill was in. But to be fair, in his entire career, Canik's only really killed two people.
Right. And, you know, not to defend him, but like you said, he was kind of a cool guy. We don't know the circumstances of those murders. We really don't know. Okay, maybe they attacked him. Maybe it was self-defense.
He was wearing a paisley button-up under a leather jacket with leather pants. He seemed cool as hell.
I'm so mad about Tito dying, because, like, I just felt like, I know it's over and the episode's over. And
I love Tito, and every time I saw him, I got really nervous, because they would just be in broad daylight talking to him. And you know how, like, yeah, sometimes in these shows they kind of fake it? Like, people will walk by and he's like, hey, man, I'm not going to tell you anything. And then he's like, hey, I'll talk to you guys later. They did not do this with him. He was like, we're friends. We're cool.
They're like, you took zero precautions. Your plan was flawed. And I'm like, flawed? They didn't do anything. We didn't see a plan, not hide nor hair.
Ugh.
Oh, gosh. Well, that was an episode. It certainly was.
And here I go. Monique Jeffries. And we never saw her again.
Wait. Oh, no. Sorry. Yeah, for real. They're perfection. Everyone should go back to episode 43 and take a listen, because it's a Christmas episode. We just talk about Christmas movies, a couple of other topics. We discuss Wicked, the girls. We thought we were ridiculous as friends, but I mean, and we talked about their friendship while wearing crowns on our heads. And I was still like,
these girls.
Can't believe these girls. So we talk about that. We talk about our favorite Christmas movies. We share some controversial takes. Spoiler alert, Brittany does not like Love Actually. And I've never been able to sit through the whole thing.
I was about to say, and now neither do you.
I can say that I don't like it, and I've never seen the end, and I probably never will.
It's boring. Well, swad.
Swad.
We will see you next time. And then they never saw us again. Bye.
Bye, Sydney. Bye, Perth.